All right, good morning one more time. That's even better. Maybe we'll try it three times. It's good to be here with you. For the past 2 weeks, we've been in the Old Testament book of Ruth together, and today will be no different. We're going to be in our third sermon from this series. If you were with us last week or the week before, I hope that you are challenged through the text. I talked about it a little bit. One thing that we're aiming for and hoping for all of us together is that maybe for some of us, the Old Testament would come to life for possibly the first time as we see how it pointed to Jesus long, long, long before he was ever born, ever came into this world as God in the flesh. For pretty much every person, if we're honest, our approach to the Old Testament part of the Bible, which is the first 66 books, the part before Jesus came, our approach to that and our navigating that, if we do not have a proper framework to view it in or place it in, can kind of make the Old Testament seem like random chaos. Maybe for some of us, it makes it seem as if God is distant, angry, maybe even capricious in the Old Testament if we don't understand some of the things going on in it. But that's not really what is meant to happen. We're supposed to see God as faithful, as the one who cares enough to send Jesus, and see the Old Testament as all of it unfolding as a promise to send Jesus. So we can think of the Bible, the Old Testament, as a promise, and the New Testament as the fulfillment of that promise, and which means that the Old Testament, whenever we navigate it, whenever we open it up, we should be asking these questions ahead of time. How is this text pointing to Jesus and his grace to us? Every single time you open it, even in Leviticus. How does this point to Jesus? How is Jesus the point of the story? How is he hidden in the story? How is it trying to show us his grace, foreshadow his grace? How is God lining things out, preparing to send Jesus? How is God lining up things to show us that we need Jesus? The whole Old Testament is doing that. And when we look at the Old Testament that way, it should change the way that we comprehend it. It should make things become a whole lot more clear. What seems to be random will no longer be random. So I hope that that's happening for some of you, and that would encourage your reading. And for some of you, even the desire maybe to read the Old Testament on your own at home. Maybe that could happen as well. So with that in mind, we'll remember that Ruth chapter 1 is the story of Naomi facing epic pain. This woman found herself as a foreigner in a distant land called Moab, but she was also a widow. She had lost her husband and her two sons. In a period of time, she looked down at the graves of three of the men that she loved. She lost everything that she cared about, and we saw that happen in the first chapter. Now, in a patriarchal society, to be a widow, especially in a foreign land, is a horrific situation. She had to grieve the loss of the love of her life, also the loss of her protection. And in that culture where she was at, she didn't have very many options to make it by during her grieving, as it was difficult even for women to own property in that culture at that time. Now, in her desperation and suffering, Naomi does something that we would probably be tempted to do if we are in her shoes. She blames God for all of her pain. She believes that God has come against her, says, "Your hand has come against me." She ends up angry that he has been unfaithful, she thinks, to his word, basically saying, "You broke your promise and I'm holding you liable. This is not what you said you would do. And I'm so angry that you have done this." And bitterness ends up grabbing her so much so that her view of reality becomes skewed, always tainted. You could say the well of her joy had been poisoned by unforeseen pain. Pain has a way of doing that. We left that chapter thinking, what in the world is going to happen next? And that's kind of where we pick up today. Now, we need to realize, because we have maybe a habit, or at least I do, have a habit sometimes of seeing people who struggle and kind of putting them in a box. So before we demonize Naomi too much, we should probably slow down just a little bit. Her faith was busted up really badly. She was not on a mountaintop spiritually, but her faith wasn't dead and gone either. We see this. Naomi's response of her heart to pain is she blames God, but what does she also do while she blames him? She walks back to him. There's a duality there. She decided to jump back onto a road to get back to Bethlehem, even though she was bitter and upset. So what this means is, in the middle of her suffering, she still believed that God was in control, that he was powerful, and that he was sovereign, but she kind of believed that he wasn't good. Yeah, you're strong, Yeah, you have power, but I really don't feel like or know that you are good anymore. She is doubting his chesed, his faithfulness, his love towards her, his covenantal kindness towards her. But as we look closely at her situation, even though she is doubting that, she wants things to change in her faith. We see that as she prays for God's faithfulness to Ruth on the way back. She prays that God would show her his chesed to Ruth even before they even get to Bethlehem. So she is bitter, she is tired, she is upset, but there's still a little spark left in her faith, and God's going to start working with that spark throughout this text. Also, before we read this text, we should know a little bit about how this text unwinds for us and how we're supposed to see it. Mainly, the best way that I can say it is we're meant to get a God's eye view of this chapter too. It's as if the author will pull the curtain back to show us more details than we are meant to see. I imagine it like the author taking us up on a cloud, and we sit over the story at 30,000 feet, and we get this huge view of everything going on, a better perspective, more detail. The author's painting a bigger picture for us so that we see way more than we would otherwise if we were down on the ground level. So if you're catching what I'm throwing down, we're going to see God work and God's perspective in this story. We're going to see him working over and above all human levels in his sovereign way to see a greater power aligning and moving and doing things to work for his children's good. The question that we'll wrestle with before we read the text is this. Do you believe that God does that? The idea is that God is going to move, align, and work. Do you believe that God still works today? Do you believe that he will intervene? Do you believe that he will act supernaturally in the lives of his people at times? Do you think God does that? You have to wrestle with that through this text. The author wants you to wrestle with it. Or possibly have you wholeheartedly moved into what is called functional deism? Functional deism is where you believe that there is a creator God. I know that there is a God, but you put little to no confidence in him ever actually doing something in your life or intervening into your life. Maybe you think that he has better things to tend to, bigger business than you, or maybe you think he just doesn't care. Maybe you think he doesn't have the power to work. Many things could be underneath the reason, but if you slipped into this functional deism that believes that there is a God, but he's behind the scenes and not active in anything that I will ever do, what does it look like to slip into functional deism? Well, possibly a complete hiatus and halt from all your prayer. If you believe that God's not going to act, I mean, why would you pray? Would be the mindset that a lot of people would have. Or maybe you still give prayers, but they're just this religious monotony thing that you do, but they're not prayers of faith because you don't actually think or expect him to do something. Even when you pray, you're aligning and justifying why he's not going to work before you've even said, amen. I wonder if that's where you're at. You maybe don't pray, have a distant heart, or don't believe that he will work. I wonder where you're at in regards to that. And even more so, I wonder if the Holy Spirit may be able to move you from where you're at if need be today. I believe that he can, and I hope that he will. So we're going to read Ruth chapter one, or chapter 2. It is 23 verses, so it is going to take a moment. I'd ask you to take your ADD hat off and follow me through this so you can understand kind of what's happening here. Ruth 2, starting in verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned into the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, right? You're supposed to focus on that. Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to this young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young men. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and your mother and your native land and came to the people that you did not know. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers and passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean and among the sheaves and do not reproach her. And also pull some from your bundles for her and leave it for her to glean and do not rebuke her." 17, so she gleaned in the field until evening, and she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley, and she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in a field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law. That is Ruth chapter 2. So did you notice at the beginning, the very first verse, there is an interesting statement that is completely separate from the narrative? It's a side note. It's a commentary note. That's that whole cloud view that I mentioned, that you're going to see above, a perspective that people down in the regular parts of life wouldn't have seen. You're going to get a detail above the process that nobody else had. It says that Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a man of the clan of Elimelech. For us reading this story, Boaz, all of a sudden, this first verse talking of him is supposed to be a bright crack in the clouds of hopelessness and bitterness that hung over Naomi and Ruth so far. The text says Boaz is a worthy man. In Hebrew, this is translated as a man of valor. That means several different things to them. He is a mighty man, a man of wealth, a man of means, a very able man. This is an overarching accommodation for him. But most importantly, what we're supposed to know by this is Boaz is a man of God. Right? He doesn't just have means and money. He is a man of God, a God-following, God-saturated man of ability. He is legit. That's what they want you to know. So we should see verse 1 as saying, the author sitting up on the cloud with you, and he goes, "Hey, look down, there's that dude named Boaz." And then all of a sudden the song, "What a man, what a man, what a man, what a mighty good man," starts playing. That's what he wants you to see. A light shines down, it glows on Boaz. There's the angels singing. The author wants you to picture that. Go, "Do you see that good guy?" Yes. All right, hold on to that, because we're going to come back to that. I just want you to notice before we get anywhere. Now, the scene will fade away and it'll start focusing back on the ladies after we have seen Boaz. But what we need to remember is what Naomi had prayed for Ruth on the road, because all of what's going to happen starts with a prayer. She says, "You know, I've got no men for you. I've got no kids. I've got no redeemer for you. I have nothing for you, no relative around, but I am going to pray for you that you find the chesed, the faithfulness of God. I have no redeemer," but all of a sudden a redeemer shows. Now, Naomi and Ruth, though they're back in Naomi's hometown, now it switches back in verse 2 to their story, though they're in Bethlehem, they had no crop to harvest. They had no money to buy food from anyone. Their immediate situation is one of complete desperation. They need a miracle still to make it by. She may be at home, at Ruth's home, but they have nothing. Or at Naomi's home, but they have nothing. So Ruth takes initiative and says that I'm going to go out into the fields and glean. She says to Naomi, is it cool, right, if I may take that liberty? Is it cool if I go and see if I can find favor in the fields? If I can go find that chesed? Remember Ruth chapter 1, verse 8, Naomi prayed, may the Lord deal kindly with you, Ruth. This word kindly is chesed. May you find the Lord's covenantal faithfulness. And now the author is trying to connect the dots. Ruth had prayed, or Naomi had prayed over Ruth that you find God's chesed. Now Ruth is going into the field going, I'm going to go look for that chesed that you prayed for me over. And she goes looking for it through the kindness of the people around. They're setting us up to see a faithfulness of God show through. There was a prayer, and then Ruth goes out looking for the answer for that prayer. Now, to grasp a hold of what happens with this gleaning, we need to understand Leviticus 23:22 and understand how their culture then worked, or at least the covenantal culture of God, what they did. Leviticus 23:22 says this, and when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, nor shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. That's a pretty strong, because I said so, you're going to do this at the end. Now, God made a law about gleaning in their time, and this law about gleaning was an expression of his love and his concern for the poor, for the stranger, for the marginalized, for the refugee, for the sojourner. It's a reflection of his kindness and his love. God was serious about helping the down and out people of the world. So he made a law that his people were to follow. The law said this, okay, there's a ring or a swath around the outside of your crops. I want you to leave it. Don't harvest it. Don't touch it. Leave it alone. Further, after you've gone through and harvested your crops, I don't want you to go back and hunt for anything that you have missed to try and get another paycheck. That's what gleaning is, to pick up the scraps. God said, okay, leave that outer swath. Don't go back through twice. I want you to leave all of that so that the down and out can come into your field and they can get food. Now, the idea behind this is so that everyone in the geographic compass of God's covenant, everyone around God's covenantal people, both the haves and the have-nots, might be fed and able to live. This means any person, native or foreigner, no matter their skin color or affiliation of any kind, had a chance to experience the kindness of God. How? Through his people. Through his people. God's people, by allowing the poor to glean, are literally saying to the poor and the people around, this is what my God is like, and I want you to see him and his generous kindness and his compassion. He has caused this to be left for you. You have a place here. We hope for your good. Come in and glean. I've left that for you. The people of God showing the kindness of God through generosity. Now, this idea is going to press on a tension that we will see in our modern culture. Because the debate about charity, if you pay attention, the debate that we see often in the political world about charity and helping the down and out in the U.S., it often focuses on if the person is worthy or has earned help. Right? Isn't this what it's talking about drug testing people and all of this stuff? And if they're foreigners or if they're not, it's all about, are they worthy of getting my money? Do they deserve to be helped? This is the modern tension that we find ourselves. But if I can make an observation and just ask it to land on you, that's not the way things roll here. God said of his people to help others, the down and out, the stranger, the sojourner, and the refugee, I want you to help those people, not on the basis of who they are. God flips the script. He goes, it doesn't matter who they are. Regardless of who they are, I want you to help them because of who I am. You're focusing on them. I want you to focus on me because it shows my character. Because of who I am, I want you to help them, even if it costs you something and even if it endangers you at times. Trust me and do it. Hear that? It's not about their worthiness. It's about God's. Do you see what this means? This means we, as the people of God, are to be generous for the main purpose of revealing God. Not to help people who we deem worthy or unworthy. Their worthiness doesn't mean anything about it. It's to show the world what God is like. It's to reveal to a broken world God and his beauty and his kindness and his chesed. The goal is for the kingdom of God to break forth into a broken world through the generosity of God, through the generosity of God's people. Again, this will press on our modern way of thinking. Because in order to do this, remember, they left the outside of their crops and they didn't go back through twice, meaning they left a lot of money on the table. They left paychecks out there, right? Because you have to follow what that means. This is difficult for us in our modern world because if we want to do that, to trust God enough to not judge people by their worthiness, but to think of God, we're going to end up having to live a countercultural life in a consumeristic world. Meaning we have to have the margin in our life to give anything away if we want to be obedient in this. That is a problem. Because the majority in our culture have no margin to leave behind anymore because they, through their materialistic worldview, and some of us through our materialistic worldview, have gleaned every single cent we could possibly get. We have nothing left. Why? Because we often live behind or above our means, beyond our means. Why? Because stuff is our God that we really worship, even if we come to church on Sunday. This is the difficulty that has been shown in there. We live beyond our means because we worship our stuff so much so that we have absolutely nothing left or available to give away for the purpose of showing the rest of the world what God is like. Church, being generous is not only a defense for the defenseless. You need to hear this. It's a defense for you as well. It aims to free you. We live in a culture that is enslaved by devouring more and more and more and more. And if you play a part, it will devour you as well. God's saying, I want you to be free from that. This will be off notes, but I wonder if we focus on other people's worthiness as a scapegoat to not focus on why we haven't left any margin. Maybe that's easier. Oh, it's easier to talk about whether you deserve my money than to actually set aside money to be generous. Just a thought. Now we get back to the text that says, Ruth went out to glean in the fields. And the author says she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. Now, I don't point this out to nerd out or try and flex up my Bible skills or my commentary reading skills, but we need to mention this word that happens here. It says happened, as in she just happened to come to Boaz as part of the field. And it's said in the original language in an interesting way. The original language is she happened to happen upon his part of the field. So they didn't have italics or underlining, or they didn't have a yellow highlighter when they wrote the Old Testament books. So when they wanted to emphasize something, they do it by repetition, by saying something over and over. So when you see this happen to happen, it's a huge flashing sign going, you better pay attention to that part. The author's pointing out the craziness of the situation, saying, what are the chances? What do you think of the chances? Because we seem to have a whole lot of coincidences lining up one after another. First, let's go back to Moab. Naomi hears in a field, right? She doesn't see it online. She hears when she walks into a field randomly one day, 50 miles away from Bethlehem, from someone who doesn't even care about that God, that God had ended the famine back in Bethlehem. She just happened to catch that conversation. Then Naomi had forgotten that there was still a redeemer and relative around. Without even hearing said relative, Ruth ends up in said relative's field. And at the exact same moment that she ends up in his field, behold, the author says he shows up. All of these things happen one after another. What the author is saying is, do you see the intersection of all this stuff? It's a whole lot of craziness happening. And the author's going, what do you think of that? What do you think of that? Remember, you're up on the clouds looking down, just elbowing you. What do you make of that? It's like the author asked the question, what do you call multiple coincidences? And before you have the answer, the ability to answer, he yells out the hand of God and then just keeps moving. So Boaz, the mighty good man, shows up in this series of coincidences in Bethlehem, and this God-saturated man looks to one of his reapers, one of his workers in the field, and he asks, whose woman is this? He sees her working, doesn't recognize her. Whose woman is this? Before we get tempted to get riled up or bothered, he's not asking whose property she is. In a patriarchal society, he's just saying, whose family is she? And I don't recognize her. He's curious about her and has no idea what house or what line she comes from and wants to know. The foreman or worker tells Boaz her story. She's a Moabite. She's the one that came back with Naomi. She's the one that left everything to care for her. Even though she was coming here to a distant land, she asked if she could glean in the fields. We told her, okay, she has been hard at work. She just took a little break. She's been no problem to us at all. Man, she's a hard, hard worker. Boaz, after the conversation with his worker, decides to then have a conversation with Ruth in the field that day. And he shows her really, really great kindness in their conversation. So don't miss it. Again, we're going to line up pieces. Naomi prayed for God to give Ruth chesed, love earlier, the faithfulness and kindness. Then Ruth goes out into the field hoping to stumble upon that faithfulness and kindness of God. And then Boaz gives it to her in spades that day. Kindness to a stranger. We're seeing prayer, then intentionality, then answer a prayer through faithfulness of God's people. All these elements line up. To make sure you grasp the depth of Boaz's kindness to Ruth that day, you probably need to understand the way their culture is lined up then. There are multiple layers of barriers between Boaz and Ruth. Ruth was a disconnected, poor, female Moabite foreigner. In their societal class system, there's 16 levels. She comes in at 16 of 16. There is no lower. The foreigner slave would have been a person of a higher standard than her in that day. She is absolutely last. No rights, nothing, while Boaz was a connected, wealthy, male Israelite clan leader. He's third, right? You could have a king slash judge and then a tribal leader, and then you have Boaz after that. There's no reason that Boaz should be talking to her. There's no reason that he should be communicating or anything. The barriers are way too great. Why in the world would he do that? And yet Boaz breaks down every single one of those barriers with one word. He walks up to her and calls her daughter. Daughter, what is he doing? He's giving her a term of kindness to not try and elevate himself over her in their dialogue. Even Ruth refers to herself as a foreigner in the chapter, but Boaz calls her a young woman and a daughter. This means that Boaz was affirming her personhood and elevating her standing above what it was in the culture. Think of it this way. Boaz was saying, I don't care what the world thinks of you. I'm going to treat you like a valued human being. You're not 16th. You're a human. And I'm going to talk to you in that way. You're made in the image of God. And so I will show you kindness because my God is kind. Might we learn something from that, church? Might it sink in this morning? A God-saturated life will not conform to valuing people by their class or race. It won't happen. Instead, it will move towards those who are hurting in kindness. Even in a racially charged culture, Boaz wouldn't let race define Ruth. And in a male-driven culture, Boaz wouldn't let Ruth be minimized by the fact that she wasn't a man. This is nothing short of the love of God through a faithful man of God being obedient to God. Church, this is where things are going to get even more challenging, though. If you don't shrug them off, if you understand that this narrative is supposed to weigh on us a little bit, notice not only did Boaz give Ruth a nice word and smile, he gave more. Right? A nice word and smile are easy. Oh, God be with you. Praying for you. That's not difficult. But he gave more. He told her, okay, don't glean in another field. Don't even leave this one. Stay close to the young women, keep your eyes on the field, go after and pluck food for yourself, and you don't have to worry. No one's going to sexually assault or harass you because I've told them that there'll be a big penalty if they do. Further, if you're thirsty, go drink from the vessels that my men have pulled water from. We don't have the time to dig into that completely. But foreigners and Jewish people, they didn't drink out of the same water well. Imagine segregated U.S. years and years ago. You didn't touch the same water thing. And they're inviting her, saying, no, you're one of us. Come in. You can drink out of this. My men will even serve you the water. He's eliminating all racial tension. You're one of us now. Come drink. This was shocking. Boaz did so much more than the law required. Remember, all he had to do was leave the fields open and go pick what you want and then leave. That's all he had to do, but he did more. His chesed, his loving kindness towards her, towards the oppressed and the marginalized, was not limited by doing the least amount necessary to get by. Hear that? Is that what your kindness is modeled by? What's the least I have to do? What's the least I have to do to pat myself on the back, to feel good, to feel like a good person? His was not limited by that. His generosity, it overflowed. He was even stubborn in the amount of generosity that he gave her. He was pushy with it. He protects her emotionally by commanding her to stay. Did you hear him? Don't even think about going to another field. Why did he do this? So she doesn't have to wonder when her welcome is worn out. Imagine yourself in the field. Some guy's like, oh, come be a part. And you're like, man, you don't know me. Like, he probably only meant that for 24 hours. He commands her to stay, so she knows that food, protection, water, and continued support is hers. He wants to stress, you're no longer a foreigner to me. You're one of us. The delegation of an other, she doesn't have anymore. You're not an other. You're in. You're one of us. Come here. This is over the top, lavish generosity from Boaz towards Ruth. And it overwhelmed her so much. She fell to her face and said, why have I found favor in your eyes? You have to understand, this is not normal what he has done. She's used to being thought of in foreign cultures as the lowest of the low. And this person has shown her immense grace. She says, why have you taken notice of me, a foreigner? Again, the original language is really helpful for us here. She says, how have you noticed the unnoticed? Let that sit. How have you noticed the unnoticed? This phrase has laid me bare this week as I studied it in the office. Noticing the unnoticed. The love of God has caused Boaz to notice the unnoticeable, to see the unseen. The love of God takes our gaze, our self-obsessed gaze, off of ourselves long enough to see other people around us, to see the unnoticeable around us. I don't know if that lands on you today, but our tunnel vision and self-preoccupation lets so many people remain unnoticeable and unnoticed to us. But self-preoccupation dies at the foot of the cross. It's laid down to, at times, probably more often than we are comfortable with, to cause us to love those who are far off, work towards reconciliation and valuing those who maybe we prior wouldn't have actually valued. When they ask the question of why, Boaz responds, well, with you've been kind to Naomi, but more importantly, you left your home, and here's the really big part, you sought refuge under the wings of God. You sought refuge in God. Boaz was telling her that God is in the business of giving refuge and rest to lost and hurting people, to giving them the rest they seek, they're desperate for if they seek it in him. This is what the book of Exodus showed us. He gave rest and refuge to the people who are in slavery. And then if you look at Matthew 11, this is the exact same thing that Jesus offers us in the New Testament. Come who are all who are weary and heavy laden. Come who are broken and busted up. Come and see that I will give you the rest that your soul longs for. Find it under my wings. God is in the business of rest and refuge. So Boaz answers Ruth, you came here looking for rest in God. And it just so happens that God is giving you that rest through me now. My kindness is a conduit of God's love towards you, daughter. Notice this. How tempted are we when people ask, man, that was so nice. Why'd you do that? Oh, man, it's nothing. I'm a nice guy. I mean, that's clearly why. He takes no credit. He says, you know, God wanted to give you rest, and he did it through me. It's him. I'm not spectacular. I'm following God. God wanted to love you, and I'm just the mode and the medium. God's people being the reconciling, loving kindness of God to people who are far off, not because they are awesome, but because God is good. Again, it's not about other people. It's about God, who is so beautiful and kind, and his character being manifest in a broken world. We then picture their mealtime that day, where we see more of Boaz's kindness towards Ruth. Now, we need to say that there's a lot of people who've read this text and they read into maybe romantic overtures before they're there. Essentially, they're going, well, Boaz thought she was a fine-looking lady and he just wanted to get frisky, so he was nice. There's no indication of that in the text. It's nowhere. If that's what he wanted, there was probably a much different way to go about it as well. This is important to understand, or else you're going to think Boaz's kindness was really tainted with self-interest, and it wasn't. There was nothing about love that had bloomed yet. But at lunch, Boaz says, come on over here, Ruth. Feel free. Don't be shy now. What does he tell her? Go ahead. Dip that bread into that wine. It's good. Come taste some of this roasted grain. It's fire. Come on. Come on over here. Man, don't sit in the corner. Move over. Come sit by me. Come sit by us. Come be a part. You don't need to be shy. Come on. Come over here. Boaz was letting her again know, you're with us. You're in. See, we're so quick to classify people. You're out. You're in. You're other. You're better. You're not as good. He eliminates all of that, going, I don't want you to feel, think, or act like an outsider anymore. Come partake in all that we partake in. What is mine is yours. Sit here. Take in and eat. The text says that she ate until she was satisfied and took a doggy bag home. It was a good day. If all of that kindness wasn't enough, Boaz then told his young male workers, okay, here's the way it's going to go the rest of the afternoon. I want you to let her glean even among the sheaves, meaning she can even go into the non-harvested stuff and pick whatever she wants. I'd imagine the workers go, say, what? I mean, that's good money. I can understand what we're meant to leave. And you gave her roasted grain, even gave her some of the good wine. Like, that's all good, but you are leaving money out on the table. That's our money. That's our stuff. We've worked hard on that. She's a foreigner, and she just came in here. Why are you going to give that to her? And he answers, because I want to. Because I want to. Because the love of God overflows for us, so our kindness will overflow to her. Anyways, don't just stop there. Here, if that's too far for you, I want you to do this. You know that stuff that you work so hard to pick? Yeah, take a little out and dump it for her too. We're going to overflow with kindness. I want you to just walk, scatter it, let her pick it up, and if anyone says anything sideways, you better tell them to knock it off. We are going to lavish love on her. She is one of us now. And she will be given all that she needs. Ruth gleaned in that field until evening. She beat out what she had gleaned. The text says that she went home with an ephah of barley. It's like 5.5 gallons of barley. One really, really big heavy sack. And she took that bad boy and threw it over her shoulder and she walks back to Naomi. The author's here trying to give us a little bit of relief emotionally. There's been all this stuff that's happened, and then we see this picture of this woman just working hard all day long and hauls this big old bag over her shoulder. We know immediately that Ruth is no dainty girl. She is a strong, driven, and amazing woman, probably not to be messed with either. Then the author wants us to picture it. Ruth had been gone all day long. Remember, she asked Naomi, can I just go try and find someone who will be kind? Maybe. You prayed for this faithfulness of God. Maybe I'll go find it through some of these people. Just let me go. And she goes, okay, fine. You can go. And she comes back. You gotta think Naomi's probably just hoping for dinner. Man, if we could just have a little bit of food, something, anything, it would help us out so much. If we could just get something. And Ruth comes back with a huge ephah of barley and a doggy bag. He says, where have you been? Girl, where did you go? Did you shank someone? We can't start off like this. That was me. That wasn't in the text. He says, no, this man, he was kind. I found it. I found the chesed. Naomi says, blessed be the man. Blessed be the man who took notice of you. There again, that phrase, he noticed. Man, let that land on you this week. Kindness and love, notice. You could probably take the inverse. When we don't notice, could that be hatred? Oh, no, surely not. Ruth says it was a man named Boaz. He was so kind to me. Put yourself in the story. Can you imagine Naomi say what? It was who? Did you say Boaz? Yeah, it was Boaz. Oh, Ruth, I forgot to tell you. I forgot to tell you about Boaz. He's a close relative. Man, he could even be a redeemer. Naomi was probably the first one plotting anything on a romantic scale here. You know how mothers are. Always getting in your relationship business. Ruth goes on to tell Naomi of the lavish kindness of Boaz extended, telling her that she's even allowed to come back and glean in the fields later. And when she does, she's going to be protected as if she's one of their own when she goes. The scene ends by fading away, letting us know that she does exactly that. Each day she goes back into the field, lives with her mother-in-law, and where there once was hopelessness, there now is provision. We're meant to feel this. They came into Bethlehem with nothing, probably the clothes on their back, tired and broken, no land to farm, no money to buy food with, absolutely nothing. By the end of the first day in the fields, just hoping to pick a little bit of barley, Naomi and Ruth have food to eat and enough extra crop to sell and even buy some stuff. Where there once was all hopelessness, empty, hungry, alone, you even wonder if they're going to live, they are now full. Full, satisfied. The author wants you to know they are satisfied with food left over, and they have a community to walk in now. Come on back tomorrow. Come on back tomorrow. So from your view up in the clouds, the author once again wants to elbow you a little bit and say, what do you make of all that? Do you think it's all coincidence? There was a good man. Ruth blindly stumbled into his field, not even knowing who he was or that he existed. She did so on the exact same day that he came to check on his field. The connotation is he doesn't come to that field every day. He's a wealthy man with a lot of properties and a lot of things going on. He just happens to show up that day. And the day he happens to show up, he notices her and feels compelled to show her kindness beyond anything normal. Are those all coincidences? Or could it be? Could it possibly be? Could we be naive enough in our modern day to think maybe it was God faithfully moving, guiding, and sustaining his weary children? That the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob stepped into their situation and gave them provision because God is in the business of giving rest and refuge to his children and all who are far off and lost. You have to wrestle with that question this morning. It's clear what the author wants you to see, but even more so, you're going to have to wrestle with what you call coincidences in your own life. I pray that you'd be given the faith to believe that maybe, just maybe, God would work for you as well. Not to be your genie in a bottle and give you everything that your heart has ever desired, because most of the time that's going to hurt you and not help you, but that he will step down and into our situations for our good because he is loving and kind to us. What do you think about that? Do you think he still does that? And lastly, can you see Jesus in the text? Remember the whole Old Testament, we need to look for the promise, the foreshadowing of Jesus. Do you see it? The author's not trying to hide it. Jesus is the better Boaz, he always would be. He's the one that notices the unnoticeable, who notices our brokenness and our strife. Paul Miller, a theologian, says, noticing is the first step of the incarnation, which the incarnation means God taking upon flesh. Just like in Exodus 3, it says God had seen the affliction of his people. God saw the affliction that you and I and others face because of our sin and separation from him. And so Jesus stepped down into our story because he noticed our pain. What if he didn't notice? What if he was preoccupied? But yet he goes over and beyond and above anything that is required of the law, just like Boaz. Jesus did not need to come. Jesus did not need to live the life that we couldn't amongst us. Jesus, Ennis has said, steps down into our situation, takes ownership of our problem, like Boaz, took Ruth under his arm, and he took on her plight to help her. Jesus comes, and on the cross, he takes upon our sin to save us as well. By doing so, he offers us what we saw in the text in chapter 1. He offers us the bread of life, which nourishes the hunger that's in our soul. He offers us protection and he offers us provision for all eternity. And then notice he makes us no longer others. We're no longer enemies of God. We're no longer labeled sinners anymore. We're called sons and daughters of the Most High. We are wrapped in, we are brought in, we are invited in this lavish, over-the-top care and kindness from Boaz. It seems ridiculous and almost dumb. It boggles the mind, making us think, why in the world would he help that woman? She is the lowest of the low, and she doesn't deserve it at all, which again points to the lavish love and grace of Jesus. Why would he help us? Sinners who don't deserve it. The author of this story is urging you to see the breathtaking love of Jesus. Look at the better Boaz who will come. Invite you in. Pay the cost. Step into your story. Eliminate all other labels upon you and call you a child. Call you one of his own. See, my hope is that today your heart would be given the faith to see that. The faith that would believe more fully in that type of Jesus and that type of love that is given to you. God has lavished a scandalous love on you and I when you did not deserve it. One that covers you, one that protects you, one that gives you rest, and so much more. Man, you guys can come back up. The hope through this text is to behold and see that love and then lean into it. So many of these stories in the Old Testament, they show us what it looks like to see the love of Jesus more easily. So the hope is that you would seek refuge in the arms of God just like Ruth did and understand what this beautiful Savior has done for you. He's cared for you. He's lavished kindness on you. Jesus, the Son of God. Remember, we talk about the class levels. We're not in the same universe, and yet he eliminates all barriers to bring us near. This is the lavish love of God. It's better than you could ever ask for him or imagine. And at this point, 3,500 years before he came, God was even saying, watch the horizon, because that type of love is coming. And the beauty that we have is that love is available. I pray that you would see that and have faith in that, and that your heart would be overwhelmed by the goodness of that today as we worship. Would you stand and pray with me? Father, I pray that we will get a better picture of your chesed, of your kindness, of your faithfulness through this, Lord. That our hearts would be filled with it, God. Not just for the purpose of joy, but Father, so that love could be poured back out. Father, I fear that collectively we have much to lament and repent for. Much of our gaze has been on ourselves, and we've left many unnoticed and unloved, God, but you didn't do that for us. So I pray that not out of condemnation or shame, but out of a reframing and refocusing on your love and goodness, that our heart would be overjoyed and that we would begin to notice and love and work towards reconciliation and loving and caring for those who are around us well, God. There are many. We repent for not looking. Thank you for your goodness and your kindness, God. May it be said of your church here that your love overflowed out of us and into the world that we live in, God. May the kingdom of God break forth into Columbia more because your love has overflowed in your people here, God. We love you. Thank you for your graciousness and kindness. Give us the gift of faith. Let us see your beauty more. Thank you for your kindness, God. Be glorified. And thank you for your mercy today. Amen.